You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 31st, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, contributing editor to the Atlantic magazine, Annie Lowry, on her book, Give People Money, How the Universal Basic Income Would End Poverty, Revolutionize Work, and Remake the World. Also on the program today, North Korea punked Donald Trump. Hopefully it won't lead to war. Meanwhile, Iran says thanks, but no thanks to a Trump visit. Hopefully, won't lead to a war. White House wants to unilaterally cut more of rich people's taxes, and they think they can. Meanwhile, the Pentagon launches Space Force. And imagine that. A federal court has the audacity to insist that our government must get consent before they drug immigrant children. Can you imagine? Lastly, LeBron James birthed a school and put Bill Gates to shame. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We have Brendan on the board today. He's doing a little dry run. So, folks, if you have any issues with the board today, you know that it's Brendan, not Matt, just so that Matt doesn't get, any nasty emails or anything like that. Brendan's going through. So far, so good, Brendan. I got a little bit confused. Because the disparity between the music and my voice. And I had the volume in there. But everything else is good. How you doing? Doing okay?
I'm fine.
Yeah. You got to put your microphone up when you talk. All right. We will get to all this and more. Oh, let's start with this. Rudy Giuliani, he's having this rolling nervous breakdown in public. And it's sort of fascinating to watch. Of course, Rudy Giuliani, his whole strategy at this point, I think this is the strategy of the entire administration, is this is probably going to end up as a situation where the public will be the arbiter as to whether Donald Trump and those around him, maybe not those around him, but whether Donald Trump should be impeached or go to jail. And any type of impeachment, and I don't know if it's going to be from Russia, collusion, or whatever it is. But I think they definitely feel this way. They are, and for a long time they've been trying to, and they know that impeachment is a political process. There is no scenario. People have asked me this over the past year or two. There is no scenario where Robert Mueller comes in and says, we've indicted the president and, put the cuffs on him. That can't happen. The indictment of a president comes from Congress. The conviction of the president comes from the Senate, and it's in the form of impeachment. Subsequent to that, could there be criminal charges brought in a traditional criminal court? Yes. But there is no scenario where he gets led out in handcuffs. So the Trump people know this is a political process, and they are constantly trying to muddy the waters. And the problem that Rudy Giuliani has is that he's just loves the sound of his own voice. And I'm saying this as someone who loves the sound of his own voice. And Rudy Giuliani, look, when you have to explain a joke, it's not funny. And when you have to explain your spin, it's not effective. Here he is on Outnumbered yesterday, trying to clean up the mess that he made on that same network just hours before.
But when I said today that there was no collusion, and therefore, and that collusion also is no crime, I've been saying that from the very beginning, so did John Dowd. It's a very, very familiar lawyer's argument that the alternative, my client didn't do it, and even if he did it, it's not a crime.
Yeah, I mean, it is. That is actually a classic lawyer's argument, except for Rudy Giuliani is really his TV lawyer. And the judge and jury in this case is not a judge and jury, but it's the public. So when you have to explain your spin, you're losing.
He's saying things that even some Fox viewers might be like, really?
Yeah, because it's just like, it's all for them. It's just like, well, that's not common sense.
Right.
That's not something.
I understand that collaborating with a foreign government because of computer hacking. I get that the founders weren't psychic. I mean, obviously we should reinstitute slavery because it was in the Constitution. But on the other hand, I'm not sure you could say that that isn't illegal because they didn't write that.
That's not something a five-year-old would understand.
The framers didn't write specifically, like, and several, a couple hundred years from now, collaborating with a foreign government on a technology we couldn't have anticipated to hack an opponent's emails. That's not kosher.
That's not kosher. Folks, Blinkist. What is Blinkist? It's like blinks of a book, almost, like snapshots. If you have a long list of books you want to read, but you simply don't have the time, Blinkist is the solution for you. It's particularly great for nonfiction books, right? It's the only app that takes thousands of those best-selling nonfiction books, distills them down to the most impactful elements, so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all on your phone. With Blinkist, you'll expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. The Blinkist library is massive, constantly growing. You can find timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich. As you know, timeless classic.
Timeless.
To current bestsellers like Fire and Fury. Right?
Current classic.
Current classic. Just to give you a notion, okay? So for me, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to listen to the 80-20 principle. This is fascinating to me. Now, and they also have, Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week.
80-20 is fascinating.
But the 80-20 principle, and this is, for me, this is the type of book I want to hear about in 15 minutes. I don't need to hear everything else. I don't need to hear the big buildup. That's these books. It basically says that 80% of results are generated by 20% of your work. And you just got to figure out what the 20% of the work are, so that you're getting you cut out the other, cut it out the other 80%, but you just don't, you de-emphasize. Anyways, you could listen to that in 15 minutes. You get everything you need from that. But
you can 80-20 it.
You could 80-20
it. It's perfect.
But they also have books like A Brief History of Time. They have Naomi Klein's No Logo. That was the first big, yeah. They have Elizabeth Colbert's book. I can't remember the name of it.
Is it The Great Extinction?
Yes.
Great book, and yep. Also No Logo, everybody should read.
Yep.
That really holds up.
Tried to get Elizabeth Colbert on. Could not get her on. She was one of the few people that could not get on. I don't know why.
She said it was a zero-sum game piece.
But it's something, in my walk to work, I can listen to two of these books. Gives you a little sense of how long it takes me to walk to work, folks. Do the math. But I would
or
check
don't.
Out... I would check out the 80-20, or if you haven't, for some reason you haven't read No Logo, start here. listen to it 15 minutes, then maybe delve into it, or Brief History of Time, any of those. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/majority to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/majority. Check it out. It'll make you smarter. It will make you smarter. I'm going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Annie Lowry. She's written this book on UBI, but she also just wrote a piece on stock buybacks. So I may indulge, because yesterday I'd mentioned this story about the stock buybacks and about, you know, Bill Lozonik, who we've had on this show, I don't know, 3 or 4 times over the years, who is convinced that so many of our economic problems are tied into sort of two basic policies. One, capital gains taxes, where you favor money that is made by money, essentially, and versus money that is made by labor, when you give it preferential treatment in the tax code. And then the idea of tax of stock buybacks, because you've created these cottage industries in the upper levels of these corporations that misalign the agendas of people, or I should say of the people who run corporations and the consumers, I guess, and the workers and the community and even the long-term health of the corporation. So I should say also rest in peace to Ron Dellums. He was Oakland's mayor for like 30 years. Somewhere around there, and then he was in Congress for like I think 30 years, someone like that, and I guess he just he passed away
yesterday. He was 82, and he was known obviously on civil rights, but also his anti-Vietnam War activism continued in his work for Congress against weapons systems and on human rights.
Yeah, he was. He was like like one of those liberal lion type of guys.
Barbara Lee has his seat now, right?
I believe so. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Annie Lowry about her book, Give People Money, How Universal Basic Income Would End Poverty, Revolutionize Work, and Remake the World. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly, or the Atlantic Magazine. I don't know if we call it the monthly anymore. Annie Lowry, author of Give People Money, How Universal Basic Income Would End Poverty, Revolutionize Work, and Remake the World. Welcome to the program, Annie.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's go through, and I should also, let me just start also by saying that you wrote a piece the other day about our stock buybacks starving the economy. That's sort of a ballywick of mine, so I want to maybe we get to that after our discussion of universal basic income. But let's start with the lowest hanging fruit in terms of the UBI. Well, actually, even before we get to how it would end poverty, just tell us what it is.
Yeah, so it's a really simple idea. So you basically imagine that the government would give everybody something like a Social Security payment. That's just, you know, like the classic UBI idea. The number that people often talk about is sort of $500 or $1,000 a month. And then there's a lot of common variance. So another idea is that the government would provide something called a guaranteed minimum income. So, you know, the government knows pretty well how much you earn through the tax system. So if you fell below, say, the poverty line or 130% of the poverty line, then they would just boost your income up through tax rebates. So those are the kind of two central ideas that people are usually talking about.
And one is a little bit more universal, obviously, than the other. But I guess, what are the implications of one being more or less universal in those two?
Yeah, so it's a good question because it sort of depends on what problem you're trying to solve, right? So say that we have a guaranteed minimum income. That's going to be a really effective way to get families out of poverty. Basically going to say, you know, there's a floor in this country. We're a really rich society. We're not going to let anybody live on $6,000 a year in cash income. We're just not going to do it. But if it's actually universal and everybody's getting it, so rich, poor, you, me, everyone, that's providing kind of a form of social insurance. It's also going to help do things like boost middle class wages, provide a kind of wage for people who are not in paid work but are still in important work, so doing things like care work if you're taking care of a kid or an elderly relative or a parent. And so, you know, the full fat UBI is sort of a more radical policy with a lot more policy implications. But if you're looking to just end poverty in the richest society that the planet has ever known, you know, you can do it through this more sort of guaranteed minimum policy.
All right. Well, let's address that. I mean, it obviously it ends poverty insofar as, I mean, almost definitionally speaking, right? I mean, if you give people the enough money so that they are no longer fall within our definition of poverty, they're no longer in poverty. But what if and I guess maybe we'll work in some of the critiques as we go through these. What of the argument that, well, okay, so we're going to pay everybody $1,000. Let's go with just the universal one. Everybody's going to get $1,000. And that will take you out of poverty. I guess presumably, if you have four people in the family, right, you're going to get $48,000 a year, and that will take you out of poverty. What happens to? Okay, so it's going to put upward pressure on wages. Presumably, it would put upward wages on prices too. No, and would there be like this game of like never catch the rabbit going around the track?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. There are not great studies about UBI itself and inflation. A lot of people have raised this issue. But I think that you can basically, let's forget UBI and let's just imagine that you have a more equitable distribution of income and consumption. So an economy like we had in the late 90s, we had more inflation then, but there are ways to temper inflation, right? Like this is a fiscal policy and you're still going to have monetary policy. And it's probably still a better equilibrium if you just, you know, are still providing more purchasing power to middle income and lower income families. So it's hard for me to see a world in which it literally all just gets eaten up by inflation. It is possible to see a world in which it gets eaten up by things like rents or rising cost of education or healthcare. So, you know, it's certainly not a silver bullet that like ensures better levels of consumption for anyone, everyone, but it does probably help get you there.
Okay. I mean, I can just imagine like, okay, if I own a bodega in a fairly low income area, and I know that all of a sudden every one of my customers now has got an extra $1,000 cash, I don't know what I'm going to do with my prices there. All right, well, let's move on to how it would revolutionize work.
Yeah. So, there's kind of two ways that I think about this. So one, and you know, I know that this is obviously something that you talk about on your show in extraordinary depth, but between declining unionization rates in the private sector, between a relatively low minimum wage by historical standards, due to increasing concentration among companies in just huge number of sectors of the economy, you've seen this, you know, declining labor share of income for decades now. And so this is kind of one way to make sure that workers are kind of getting their fair share. If you had $1,000 a month to fall back on, it's unlikely or less likely that you would take a job for $8 an hour that was dangerous, degrading, something you wouldn't otherwise do, right? Like, you're not going to find a lot of slaughterhouse workers for $8 an hour if you're also providing them with $1,000. So that's one way. And then another way that it's theorized that this could be a good thing is that, you know, we've known for hundreds of years that GDP and national income and national accounting really only accounts for certain types of work, and that's paid work. But there's a huge amount of unpaid labor that's done, primarily by women and often by women of color. That's really important to the economy functioning, right? Like, somebody needs to be taking care of babies, somebody needs to be taking care of older people, people who might be sick, people with disabilities. And so this is kind of a way of providing a sort of social wage for that kind of work, because we're coming into this, you know, we have an existing child care crisis that's really just, you know, it's driving women out of the labor force. It's sort of difficult for families all over the income scale, which is kind of an interesting thing, although obviously it's much harder for women who are low income or parents who are low income. And then, you know, we have a coming care crisis, one that's probably in a lot of cases already here in terms of elder care. And so, you know, if that work is socially beneficial, but it's hard to make a living doing it, and it's very hard to pay for in some cases, you can imagine that this is sort of a way of addressing that. It's certainly not the only way to address that. But it would probably provide families, and especially low-income families, with more choice to either stay in the labor market or leave, to pay for care or not. And that could be a really good thing.
So broadly speaking, it empowers labor and empowers people to make choices as to where they actually expend effort and work. You know, broadly speaking, work without having to worry about having the ability to make money at it, I guess.
Yeah, ideally, this is a way of providing people with more freedom and more choice. And so, you know, before you were pointing out that there's this kind of technical definition of poverty, right? Like, are you above or below this line? And that's like an important definition, and getting above it is really important. And we know that the simple mathematical fact of getting above it has all sorts of other good beneficial effects on families and kids and people. But, you know, there's this like broader sense in which poverty is about social exclusion. It's about not having choice. And so I think that if you think of this as basically, you know, being a way to provide more choice, more freedom, perhaps even more dignity to people, or at least starting to think about ways to do that, again, given that we have this amazing, productive, huge economy, but we still have so many folks that are like, wow, you know, I can barely make ends meet, or I'm not making ends meet. But that's a kind of like sort of more powerful philosophical idea that a lot of people have behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I think at one point you referred to it as an ethos. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Like, on the one hand, this is kind of a technocratic policy fix, you know, and in another hand, we could be talking about, well, okay, is this better than an EITC expansion, or is this better than a child credit, or, you know, a universal cash payment of some other kind to some other group of people? And that's all well and good. But I also think that it really, the thing that I find so interesting about it is it just forces you to ask yourself what questions policy could answer and why we don't answer them, right? Like, what problems we just leave and we say, well, that's just, you know, that's capitalism, that's a free market, that's our society, that's how we are. And it's not even to say, it's funny because I'm, you know, with some of these questions, I'm not even sure UBI is the best way to address them, but it at least begs the question of how things might be different.
Right. And that's what I find interesting about it, too. But let's, before we get to remake the world, as we cover all of your, the subtitle, let's just address some of the critiques from the right before we get to the critiques from the left. You give people money, and of course, then you've turned the social safety net into a hammock, haven't you?
Yeah, it's a common critique. It's not one that I think holds much water. There is certainly an amount of money that you could give people that they would stop working. That's absolutely true, right? Like, if we gave everybody $150,000 a year from somewhere and made no other changes and prices stayed constant, like, I think a lot of people would stop working and would just, you know, enjoy themselves, spend time with their family.
Right, and that would be horrible. Right?
Awful.
I mean, can we just even imagine a world where everyone would enjoy themselves and spend time with their family? That would be a horrible thing to have happen.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you on that. And I certainly hope that the robot apocalypse makes it so that none of us really have to work anywhere. I think that would be great. But yeah, look, like, yes, at UBI, we have studies of this, and it shows that people stop working. Some, not that many. And the people who reduce their work effort, as the literature puts it, or quit working, are often young people who stay in school for longer. They are the parents of young children. And then they are older folks who choose to retire or step back from work a little bit early. It's hard to convince me that those are bad things.
Right. I mean, that's also, it's an arbitrary definition of what we constitute, what we define as work. Right. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
It's quite possible if I'm going and taking care of my elderly parent or I'm taking care of my young child, I'm doing work. It's just I'm not being paid for it. I'm certainly doing something that's valuable to society and something that I could pay someone to do. It's just that when I choose to do it, I'm not getting paid.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and it's hard, right? Like, does that mean that you're going to have a lower employment to population ratio and possibly a lower GDP? Yeah, it does. But those are not really totally, they're not whole measures of welfare, right? Like, it's not capturing everything. So I think that that's important. I would also note that the more punitive measures to get people to work, like work requirements, they tend to speed up how fast people get a job. But there's not a lot of evidence that they get people out of poverty. And in fact, people who can't comply with work requirements who get sanctioned end up in really deep poverty. And so, you know, I understand that there's this argument that the government just wants to encourage human flourishing by getting people into the workforce and keeping them there. And I do think that sort of policies that focus more on carrots than sticks, so like the earned income tax credit, have proven really valuable. But I do think that, you know, our conception of work can change. Even our conception of how to measure the health of our economy and our polity can change. And so, you know, again, I don't see a mom of three kids or a dad who wants to be with his parent when his parent is dying. You know, it's such a bad thing for them to stop working.
Well, I mean, if you give them $12,000 a year, they're going to want to do that every time one of their parents are dying. And that's going to be, largely that's what it is, right? I mean, the argument ultimately boils down to someone's sense of morality and of, you know, what that, you know, literally like idle hands are the devil's plaything. I mean, even if we can argue about whether people are actually idle, that's a data point that is probably measurable in some, if we had the ability to measure that. But ultimately it's a moral hazard argument, and it's a very specific sense of morality on some level that people are promoting. And I would also add, we never hear it in the context of like wealthy people's kids.
No, never. Nobody is ever like, you know what? We actually want to tax capital income higher because we want people to be wage earners. We want them to be working in that way instead of receiving passive income. You know, like, never heard anybody make that argument. I've never heard anybody say we're going to attach work requirements to the mortgage interest deduction, right? Like, this is a way in which, you know, we have Puritan roots, right? And it shows up in policies like this. And, you know, I do, and I think you're also right to gesture to this way in which, like, hopefully in the future we could work less, right? Like, that would be great if the economy grew in such a way that we had such wealth that we could actually sort of step back a little, which is, you know, other societies have valorized that, right?
That's the way. I've referenced this before on the show, but I bought a steamer trunk years ago at a yard sale in outside of Boston, and there was an article from the Miami Herald from like a futurist in the 40s who was giving a talk, I guess, to a ladies' luncheon or something to that effect, but said the real challenge that we were going to have by the end of the century is going to be, what are we going to do with our 4-day work week? Because technology is going to free us all, and we're going to have to just, the real challenge is going to be figuring out what we do with our downtime. But that, still waiting for that.
If only.
But all right. Yeah. So let's talk about the efficacy of just handing people money, and to the extent that we've seen any studies or examples of this around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So low and middle income countries, it's very popular. More than 100 of them have either unconditional cash transfers, so like if you're poor, we just give you money, or conditional ones. The two biggest exemplars of this are you know, the two that sort of started the trend and are pointed to most often, a program called Bolsa Familia and Oportunidades, which are in Mexico and in Brazil. And those are conditional. So basically they say to poor families who are in those countries tend to be a lot poorer than even the poor families here, if you have your kid vaccinated, and if your kid is enrolled in school, then you can receive this transfer money. And so those, they work great. They work really well. And we have to study after study after study, both in a low-income country context and in high-income country context, showing that if you just give people cash, they consume more, which is kind of the idea. But their kind of pattern of consumption doesn't tend to change. So they're not off like gambling and buying alcohol and that kind of thing. You know, they buy more groceries, basically. It just, you know, it makes their lives a little bit easier. And especially in low-income countries, we don't have evidence that it reduces work effort at all, because in those cases, you know, you still are, even with the transfer, facing the issue of, you know, how you just get food on the table in a lot of cases. So yeah, just giving people cash works really well. It's not something that we do outside of Social Security here, because there's that, you know, kind of, again, cultural belief that your Social Security payment is yours and you paid for it and the government doesn't have any right to tell you what to do with it. Obviously, that's like, I think, a little bit of a misunderstanding of the accounting. But for something like food stamps, they're very restrictive, right? Like in some places, this is my favorite example about food stamps. In some places, you have to make sure that you're buying domestically produced cheese. So can you imagine you're a parent who's trying to feed your kid with liquor or food stamps, and you have to like look at where the cheese was made because God forbid you don't buy the right cheese. And again, we just have all these kind of restrictive things. And, you know, maybe you do have food stamps or SNAP benefits. Maybe that helps you out. But you're missing your gas payment. You're about to get your electricity turned off. You really need your car fixed. And so that SNAP payment doesn't necessarily help with those problems. The money would be much more valuable to you if it were fungible.
And we should add, too, that the value of this is you know, stretches to people who I think are, you know, involved in more or less, for lack of a better term, you know, the gig economy, where you ride out ebbs and flows. I mean, I think there's been a significant amount of research that one of the problems with poverty is that your money comes in chunks at times, and there are times of the year where you have no money, and other times of the year where you have a little bit more, but you're just paying off bills. This would sort of, I guess, even things out a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It would help provide kind of, it'd be kind of like insurance, right? You know, you're never going to be literally without, and that maybe you won't have to, you know, maybe you're not even consuming that much more, but you don't have to make those sudden trade-offs. You don't have to like sell your car in order to keep your lights on type thing. And that would be great, because I think that you're right that, you know, lower income families are often having the problem of just not having enough money, but they're also facing the problem of that kind of financial fragility. And, you know, especially if your community or your family is lower income, who are you going to go to if all of a sudden you need, you know, $500 or something? And that's just, you know, a constant problem. And again, it's, you know, on these measures of fragility, they just really haven't gotten better in a long time. Again, just like the economy growing quite a bit.
All right. So let's move. I mean, I have wrestled with my feelings about the UBI for some time, and I'm increasingly becoming a little bit nervous about it. So let's move on to some of the critiques maybe that we would hear from the left a little bit, which is the remake the world part. Because some of the concern is on the left that this will end up, and it was conceived in some circles, as a replacement for the social safety net. So you don't have economic stabilizers that kick in, maybe like food stamps. Maybe you do it partially just when, I don't know, GDP drops or unemployment drops or, you know, whatever. But there's a lot of concern that a program like this is going to replace the social safety net, which it seems to me it's almost like it's, you know, during the Trump administration, this has been a great lesson, it seems to me, about programs that have any sort of regulatory reliance on regulatory agencies to set anything, right? Like, so we can see how Trump is able to basically unwind the ACA with a little tweak here and a little tweak there. In fact, it was a Republican congressman who had to beg Trump to salvage the I think it was the risk adjustment payments recently. And had he not, the private insurance component of Obamacare, you know, and you combine that with what's happening with the navigators, all stuff that is sort of like below the statutory level is but much of the program's contingent upon this. It seems to me there's a real danger with a UBI that we're going to be in the same situation. We're going to set it for $1,000 a month today, and then Donald Trump will be president or Tom Cotton will be president, and he'll say, you know, whoa, my labor department says that actually you only need $850. And then we just,
right?
I mean, isn't that the biggest concern about a program like this? From the left,
yeah,
I guess?
Yeah, I mean, so from the left, I think that I share that concern, and I think that there are a couple other good ones. So, yes, if you only have a single lever of policy, then that lever becomes that much more vulnerable, right? At least now, if you're cutting food stamps or hurting the ACA, you know, other policies exist, right? I think that that's a good and a very real concern. And so then, you know, I have some other concerns too. So like one is that, you know, depending on what policy you're trying to solve, a UBI is a pretty diffuse policy. So if you're just trying to deal with, you know, wages for the middle class, there might be better ways to tackle that. I also think that there's a way in which a UBI could lead to a reduction in progressivity. You know, if you think like Charles Murray of AEI, who's a libertarian, likes the idea of a UBI, in part because it just cuts the safety net and everybody gets the same thing, where, you know, given our Gini coefficient and everything else, you know, there's a lot of evidence that we actually need more progressive policy. We need more redistribution. A UBI in which everybody's getting the same thing doesn't get you there. So those are all issues. You know, I do think that there are good critiques of this from the left.
And I mean, and so from, I guess, what is the, I mean, how do you foresee something like this being adopted? I mean, have you like sort of like sat down and said, here's scenario one, here's scenario two, here's scenario three. And how many of those scenarios are attractive in that regard? I mean, if you are someone who perceives that the problem that we have is not just that we don't provide enough for, you know, a basic standard of living for folks, but also that we have this sort of instability that comes from having this radical inequality. And not just inequality in the context of income, but really, you know, things like education, things like health.
Yeah.
What how many of those scenarios are nerve-wracking if those are your issue sets that you're concerned about?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that there's a thin edge of the wedge here, or sort of a tip of the spear, right? So there are smaller scale policies that I think share this ethos that I think are much likelier to become policy that Democrats will focus on, I think, if and when they come back into power. So things like eliminating child poverty through a universal child grant, or even a means-tested child grant, that would be great money for the federal government to spend. That is straightforwardly an investment in the health and education of America's future workers. We have disgusting rates of child poverty in the United States. It's about 22%, whereas Denmark, which is not a richer country than the United States, the rate is 3 or 4%. And so, you know, kids don't vote, right? Like, I'm not sure that's going to get a ton of people to the polls, but that could be a good thing and not crazily expensive, right? Not that I think that we need to worry too much about paying for things, but it is. It's a more marginal policy. Things like expanding the earned income tax credit, which would be great for the middle class, along with supportive policies like raising the minimum wage, requiring employers to provide leave, that would be really, really good. And I do think that you're just seeing a lot more blue sky thinking on the left. You know, obviously, right, from Bernie folks, from people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and also, you know, from the you know, sort of more centrist Democratic politicians that are really rushing to the left, you know, so the Cory Bookers of the world. And so I think that the Overton window is really expanding. The policy that I'm actually most enamored of, and I really wish that somebody would take up, and I love drawing attention to, comes from three researchers at the University of Michigan that show with something called a negative income tax, which basically you just give people more money depending on how poor they are. It's kind of a complicated mechanism, but it's an easy sort of idea. We could actually eliminate poverty in the country with no more than we spend on current anti-poverty policies. So this could just become more effective. Even if we just wanted to add that on to other things, it would only cost about $200 billion a year, which, yes, is a lot of money, but compared to the Trump tax cuts,
We just added $70 billion a year in our defense budget. And I don't know if there, I mean, I'm exaggerating, but if there were more than like two dozen, you know, articles written about it, or if anybody wrote about it for more than a week to add that $70 billion and the idea that, you know, two and a half times that would get rid of poverty is pretty stunning. Right, like we just did that.
It's
70
crazy,
billion,
right?
like there was more controversy over, you know, I don't know, somebody getting pulled from a soccer game than that $70 billion.
Yeah, exactly. As you point out, I mean, the government has a lot of space to spend. It's not a crazy thing to think about. And I think it just points to the fact that there's not political will for this, but I'm hoping that there will be. And that, you know, as people increasingly get fed up and say, hey, we've had, you know, another 9-year recovery and it's still not feeling better for me, that maybe there is just more space for this kind of thing.
All right. Let's turn our attention for a moment to this idea of stock buybacks.
I've
on this program had the opportunity to talk to Bill Lozonik, who's a professor at UMass, a couple of times over the years about two things that he basically, he thinks that have led to an enormous amount of wealth inequality in this country. And that is the reduction in the capital gains tax. And this is on a day where apparently Larry Kudlow has the idea that the administration is going to change the cost basis of involved in the calculation of capital gains tax to effectively lower the taxes paid by wealthy people on the money that derives from their money. But Lozonik says the stock buybacks coupled with the capital gains and the subsequent increase in compensation in the form of stock options to basically C-suite folks and board of directors accounts for a lot of problems that we have in terms of wealth inequality and job loss and whatnot. how is it that we basically allow stock manipulation to be legal?
Yeah, so we didn't for a long time. This was discouraged through regulatory policies, not outright banned until 1982. And that's when it kind of took off. And so, you know, for folks who might not be as familiar, the idea is that a company would take profits or, you know, cash reserves or even take a loan, issue debt, to purchase its own shares, which inflates the value of those shares. There's a lot of arguments that a better way to return money to shareholders, which is something that companies absolutely do, is through dividends, which is basically where you just kind of issue cash back to the people who own the shares instead of buying the shares. And so, you know, this has all sorts of distortive effects on valuation, corporate valuation. It was barred because it was seen as manipulating the stock market. And it's kind of, you know, short-term juice, right? You're just giving a little bit of a bump to people who can then go sell their shares or just continue to hold them or trade them. And, you know, I think that there's some evidence that this has led to a decrease in corporate investment and thus to companies taking cash and just getting their shareholders richer instead of becoming more innovative or more efficient. And then, you know, there's this issue that here companies have made this argument that they can't pay workers more, but they clearly can, and they just don't have to. There isn't enough competition between, you know, rising corporate concentration, things like the minimum wage and leave policies. You know, it's just workers are cheap. And, you know, so I think that you've just seen this extraordinary skew in the economy, which, again, I know it's something you talk about a lot. This kind of inequality is something that the founders were terrified of. We have tons of evidence that it's both bad for the economy and bad for democracy. And we have all sorts of ways to ameliorate it without totally soaking the rich, right? Without, you know, we're not talking about like confiscatory policies here. We're just asking companies to provide dividends instead of stock buybacks, which is what they normally do. And many of them still do.
I want to add that I am for confiscatory policies, but that aside, I mean, it's I think on some level it's even narrower than shareholders. I mean, here's this piece from Politico the other day. The Oracle Corporation CEO sold $250 million worth of shares in her company. The product development head sold $85 million. The sales came after the company announced a $12 billion share repurchase, right? So their stock values pop. And a dozen people at the company, maybe 15, the board of directors, I'm sure, they sell their stocks. Like, their interests are so misaligned from the long-term health of the company, the fate of their workers, the communities they work in. They're running a cottage industry. It's like sitting down at the table and a guy playing poker, and it's really all about the side bets that are driving every single thing. You know, it's why they make betting against, you know, baseball if you're playing illegal, because these guys don't have the same interests as what we traditionally assumed a corporation has.
Yeah, exactly. And I do. It's just this hard thing. I do worry that even putting the worker issue aside, you know, if we've seen this dramatic decline in corporate investment and we feel like productivity is low, you know, what is that doing to corporate dynamism? What is that doing to the broader economy, even leaving the questions of inequity and inequality aside? And, you know, I agree that I just think that the amount of help that is going to the holders of capital, the amount of benefit versus the amount of benefit and encouragement of financial stability and growth among lower income families, just really stark. And that's even as the economy, as the government does do a lot of redistribution and does have a lot of policies, it's just not keeping up with the tide here, right? It's like the things are working at odds.
Absolutely. Well, the book is Give People Money: How a Universal Basic Income Would End Poverty, Revolutionize Work, and Remake the World. Annie Lowry. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Thus concludes the first half of our program. Just a reminder, you can support the first half of the program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you become a member, you not only support the first half of the program, we give you an entire second half of the program. In fact, I'm not going to get all mathy with you. I know for some people who listen to this program, math is difficult. But I'm going to throw around a couple of fractions. Okay?
I thought it was we that were opposed to math, and the listenership was passionately in favor of it.
I've been practicing my fractions.
I hope everyone took their Ritalin today.
And
you're killing our core
brand proposition,
dude.
If the entire show was 10, 6/10 of that show would actually be the fun half. 4/10 of that show is the free half. So we call them halves. But the fact of the matter is that when you're just listening to the free show, you're not even getting a half. You're getting less than half.
You should call it the fun 6/10.
Or
5/8, as the case may be.
And that's exactly right. But that does not roll off the tongue. So we still say fun half. But people should know it's really the fun 6/10. Or 3/5.
Ooh.
Right?
Yeah.
9/15.
You have been practicing your fractions.
I've been practicing my fractions.
I'm just so grossed out by the math talk.
There you go.
We made a very clear decision, I believe about 2 years ago, that we were opposed to math. We wanted to eliminate it in the curriculum. We wanted the country to be just sort of numbers illiterate.
Over the weekend, I was boning up on my fractions.
very disappointing.
Yeah, I apologize. Folks, join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You can get organic. I think it's all organic. Is it?
It's my understanding.
You can get the Majority Report blend there. And with the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off. So check it out. Folks, today is Tuesday. Tomorrow, I will be headed to New Orleans, Louisiana, for Netroots Nation.
You aren't from around here, are you, boy?
Well, I mean, nobody goes to New Orleans.
No, I know. That's why it's so funny. It's like Sam just ends up like on the set of True Detective.
The last
I believe in consequatory taxes.
The last time I was in New Orleans, maybe this is more of a fun half story.
Ooh.
But
become a member today. Majority.fm/become a member. Find out what happens.
That's right.
Sam's
New Orleans sojourn. I'm going to do it right
that's
on
what
the
I'm
other
saying.
Side.
Yeah. See you on the flip side.
Yeah, it is. Whoa. I'm going to New Orleans for Netroots Nation. I will be broadcasting live in there. We're going to pipe it into the studio on Thursday and Friday. Today is Tuesday. Tonight is Tuesday night. On Tuesday nights, the Michael Brooks Show happens almost like 3 feet from where I'm sitting.
Right.
And right there.
Wait, one more math.
What's that?
Three feet? Stop with the numbers.
3 feet is not math.
Math enough. It's math.
How many inches are in 3 feet?
It's math adjacent.
36 inches.
That's
from
math.
Where I'm at.
That, boo. Stop it.
Someone's been helping a middle schooler with her homework.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 1 yard away from me.
The Koch brothers have not been able to break into this office and delete the recording of Anna Kasparian and I's ruthless roasting of Dave Rubin. I was going to say I felt bad for him. I never did. It's really fun. And then Bree Joy, crew, regular, she's in. We're talking about Sorry to Bother You. We're talking about she just was campaigning or had a campaign with Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez in Kansas. Some lessons about that for the midterms in 2020. And then I do want to keep kind of giving hints of these illicit histories on Sunday for patrons. Milton Alamadi and I are talking about the origins of the Congo Civil War, going back to the coup against Lumumba and the role of our iPhones in it.
And Jamie, the Intifada.
Yeah, so we just recorded a new episode last night with our friend Brandon Jordan, who travels around the world making documentaries about global uprisings. Pretty cool. And it really gets into a lot of talk about right-wing populism, anti-fascist movements, why you can only fight the far right with the far left, et cetera, et cetera. Also, we have a new YouTube channel up at, it's called The Antifada Podcast. You know what? I might even put a link to it in the blog post today because the link is too long for me to say right now. And it's got most of our recent episodes. We're working on getting all the old ones up there. And also a trailer for our first patron reward video, Acid Kitchen.
Wait, what the heck is going on here?
Jesus.
Wait, wow. Look at Matt. This is a rare Matt comes in.
Let me also. Whoa. Oh, well, wait, really quick. Oh, I forgot to say patreon.com/TMBS. Now, Matt, please go ahead.
Hold on for 1 second. I will say this, Jamie. Get a URL and then forward it to your YouTube channel. It's a little digital tip.
Oh, man.
All right. To folks, as you know, Brendan is working the board today. So we have a special guest on the
free flip.
On the
plane zone defense.
Yeah, planes. Yeah, you got to speak into the microphone.
Oh, am I up? Yeah. Patreon.com/literary hangover. Talking about Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Fucking Hawthorne, yeah. Dude.
There you go.
Short and sweet.
Thumbs up. Wow.
Hawthorne, capitalism, really exciting. Fucking weed.
All right, quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. See you there.